Ready? And you, Mr. Drew? You ready? Okay, we'll go ahead. All right.
Hi, House Ways and Means Committee, I'll come to order. President and Representative Samuels, Representative Seitz, Representative Wilson, and myself, Representative Wyrock. We're glad to have the same group of folks who are here. Special Committee on Ways and Means does not have any bills right now to take up, but we are going to take up an overview with the Department of Revenue of debt issues, revenue forecasts, and we'll ask Commissioner Corbis to come forward, please, and whomever you want to join the table, go ahead and invite them to this room.
Good morning, Chairman. Can you come join me?
Thanks for coming, Commissioner Corbis. We're glad to have you here before us again. Deputy Commissioner Booth, nice to see you. So why don't you go ahead, Commissioner Corbis, and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bill Corbis, Commissioner of Revenue, and to my left is Tom Buchan, Deputy Commissioner. Also present from the Department of Revenue today is Dan Dickinson, Director of the Tax Division, who should be standing by telephone in Seattle. Dan, are you with us?
We've lost our connection.
Well, he's momentarily expected. Also, we have present Dr. Michael Williams, who is the state's new petroleum economist. He has a distinguished career. He is replacing Chuck Logsdon, who you know for many years as our price guru. And finally, we have Brett Freed, who is an economist for the tax division.
Is it Brett?
Brett.
Okay, thank you, sir.
The outline for our presentation today, Tom Buchan and I will present the department's views of the financial condition of the state. Then we are going to have a review of the highlights of the fall revenue forecast, and Mr. Buchan, Mr. Freed, Mr. Dickinson, Mr. Williams and myself will be available to answer questions concerning the forecast. Well, let's look at the state's financial condition.
For the record, we're joined by Representative Bloomberg. Hi, Max.
Excuse me,
we're
having you. No, you want to just ask them if they can hear you online.
Mr. Dickinson, are you online? Is anyone online? Can you hear me?
This is Dan Dickinson. I'm online.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Have you just joined us?
I have just joined you seconds ago.
Okay. For your information, Commissioner Corbis has indicated you would be joining us, introduce the folks from the Department of Revenue, and is going to begin his testimony.
Great. Thank you.
The state's financial condition. We'd like to look at this over three time periods. The short term, the long term, and the very long term. The short term, our condition is good, and Tom Buchan is going to expand on that. The long term, which I'll address, is the outlook is bad, and the very long term, when we say the very long term, we mean after we have a gas pipeline and perhaps ANWR is producing oil, the condition we look for things to be good then. Tom, you want to give us our view on the short-term outlook for the state, financial?
Yes, sir.
The state?
Yes, sir.
The way we depict the short-term financial picture, it depends on three components, the cash flow, the reserves, and liabilities. Credit ratings are an independent report card of the financial picture today, as we depict it to the rating agencies, and then they tell us what they think. The fall forecast combined with the FY05 budget and the submitted FY06 budget shows a net surplus for the 2 years. Also in OMB's FY06 governor's budget fiscal summary, the 06 budget shows a year-to-year spending reduction. So short-term cash flow looks positive. The fiscal management of the past two budget cycles has been recognized by the credit rating agencies, and I'll mention that in a moment. Switching now from fund balances, which of course, when we're talking about the budget, we're talking about fund balances, to cash balances, which we depict to the credit rating agencies and are the best measure of liquidity.
Is that the same as reserve?
Yeah, cash reserves are substantial. The general fund has a cash balance of about $290 million. Another $30 million is in a daily suspended account until reconciliation, and some portion of that will be general fund. The constitutional budget reserve has about $2.15 billion today, and remember, this is cash, not fund accounting, and the permanent fund has over $29.5 billion when I looked the other day, for a combined liquidity of $32 billion. For this level of overview today, I didn't survey the liquidity of the various independent agencies, corporations, and instrumentalities, but of course the state owns those and has liquidity in each of those. What the State Bond Committee and Department of Revenue show the rating agencies for their reserve calculations and their measures of liquidity is the general fund and the CBR balances combined, plus permanent fund earnings reserve, and that we show as the balance available for appropriation, and we compare that along with forecasted revenues and current year and expected budgets, and that's the liquidity and reserves that the credit rating agencies, their analysts, have always used for measures of the state's current fiscal health. Short-term liabilities consist of about $13.8 million annually for debt service on lease debt, and $19.7 million this year, and $31.8 million for FY06 for general obligation debt service. Another $9 million each year is for the so-called Garvey bonds, and while those have a general obligation pledge with them, the debt service is substantially paid by federal receipts. As an aside to the discussion about short-term liabilities, just in case it would come up, total general obligation debt outstanding on last June 30 was $461.9 million, including those Garvey bonds, and state lease debt outstanding was another $203 million. And those two combined, we call, and the credit rating agencies see that as our general fund indebtedness.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative.
Do we have a handout on those figures?
Yeah.
Well, I don't believe you have a handout. In effect, you do. One of the handouts is the credit rating reports that I'll talk about in a minute, and those do have those numbers. So come to think of it, you do, but I did not provide a table that shows the amounts of debt outstanding. I sure can be glad to provide that. As a matter of fact, in this stack, I do have one copy that shows current
sooner or
debt
if you could provide
yeah.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Representative Rubin.
It would be helpful. It's really hard to copy all these figures down.
Sure.
If you could give us, a sheet with all the figures so we can have it in.
Through the chair, glad to do that, Representative Greenberg. Another $689 million was on 6/30/04 was the state reimbursable portion of municipal school debt. The different credit rating agencies treat that differently. That is, not each credit rating agency treats that the same, since it is not just subject to annual appropriation, as lease debt is, but also the legislature has in the past not appropriated the full reimbursement amount, And since it does have the general obligation of the state in front of it, we don't include that in general fund debt for what the Department of Revenue and State Bond Committee produce. Another long-term liability, but one of a very different nature than debt, is the unfunded pension liabilities and total unfunded liabilities for PERS and TERS as of 6/30/03 was $4.959 billion. Final topic in the area of liabilities is the credit ratings. Credit ratings are a direct measure of the state financial condition. The three credit rating agencies track state revenues and the budget process and maintain regular contact with the State Bond Committee and Department of Revenue. They receive formal presentations from Governor Murkowski and or members of the cabinet three or four times a year. The state general obligation ratings are AA from Standard & Poor's, AA2 from Moody's, and a AA from Fitch Ratings. To varying degrees, the ratings anticipate a so-called fiscal solution, and so, if you will, a fiscal plan that has yet to be adopted is already discounted in the rating. And by fiscal solution, I mean a plan that matches recurring revenues with expenditures. The rating agencies anticipate one will be adopted.
Based on what?
Based on their belief that the state will have no choice but to adopt one, and if the state didn't adopt one after, say, a current year and forecasted year of a significant decline, then I think the ratings would start to reflect that there wouldn't be a fiscal plan, whereas the ratings today reflect that the rating agencies expect that there will be one.
Substantial decline. Was $650 substantial deficit 2 years ago? That's where we were when we sat
well,
here before.
Yes, it was, and let me finish this, and you'll see actually how the rating agencies, and one rating agency in particular, viewed a change is underway. And the state recently had good news from Moody's Investors Service in that a statement of negative outlook had been put on the state's credit ratings back in the summer of 2002. And then on November 19, Moody's removed that cloud over all state ratings, and there was certainly a basis points, an interest rate cost in having that cloud over the state's ratings. So, that's very good news. Governor Murkowski asked Moody's Investor Service to take that to make that change back in February of 2003, only 8 weeks or so after he had been sworn in as governor. And then each time he talked with Moody's, he asked them again to remove that. I think it's possible to misunderstand the meaning of Moody's taking the action they did, and their write-up is one of the handouts. They cited conservative financial management. I think a credit rating analyst will do what he or she can to acknowledge when an elected official tells him what he's going to do and then follows through and does it. And so that's the light in which I see this change rather than today's oil price or something like that. Last week, the state had its credit ratings affirmed in the course of obtaining ratings for a $27 million refinancing of lease debt. The State Bond Committee will be auctioning that debt on January 25th, and we'll send over an invitation for anybody who wants to come to watch that. We have a competitive sale on the internet, and we'll accept bids until 8 a.m. on January 25th. There's handouts that have the credit rating write-ups from each of the agencies on this debt and the state's general obligation rating, and then the write-up on the Moody's outlook change. To summarize, the short-term financial condition is very strong. Liquidity is very high. Fiscal decisions made by the governor have been recognized by the credit rating agencies that have followed the state's credits and statehood.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Pretend. For the record, joining Mr. Dickinson online is Representative Roper. Representative Roper, the note here indicates you wanted to testify. Or did you want to testify at some point, or are you just listening in to testify telephonically?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm just participating as a member of the committee.
All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Corbis.
We'd like now the overview of the state's financial condition to move on to the long-term outlook for the state. And I'm sure we've all been through this before, but the state has a long-term structural financial problem. Regular reoccurring revenues are expected to be less than reoccurring expenditures. And that has been the case most of the time if you look back over the last 10 years. And just to illustrate, we'd like to refresh your memory about the history of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. This fund was established in 1990 by a constitutional amendment from settlements from oil tax and royalty litigation. The idea was that during poor revenue years for the state, mainly when the price of oil is down, that we would borrow from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, and during good revenue years, years of high oil prices, that we would repay the Constitutional Budget Reserve. Unfortunately, it hasn't quite worked out that way. During the last 10-year period, 7 out of the 10 years, we've borrowed out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The state in total has deposited $5.6 billion into the Constitutional Budget Reserves from oil settlements and has earned an additional $1.6 billion. During this time frame, it has drawn out a total of $5.1 billion such that the CBR today equals $2.1 billion. I think it's safe to say that when the CBR was set up, that it was intended that we'd still be at this $5 billion level. But we find ourselves that at the $2 billion, the administration has been successful in keeping it at that level for the last several years. But over time, it has been depleted, and looking to the future, as we will discuss later, the outlook for the CBR is not good. This administration has exercised strong fiscal discipline, and the price of oil certainly has helped, so that we do find that that the life of the CBR has been extended from some of the earlier predictions. But as we'll discuss in the fall revenue forecast, the fund is predicted to be depleted sometime between September of 2009 and April of 2010, depending on the spending level that you assume. We're assuming somewhere between 2.4 and 2.5 billion per year to come up with those parameters. The governor has stated that it is his policy that under no circumstances is he going to let the CBR fall below a minimum of $1 billion. And this $1 billion is needed for two reasons. One is to cover the volatility in the price of oil. A budget is based on a certain projected price of oil, and if the actual price turns out less than that, obviously revenues are going to be less than projected, and that the fund would be available for that. And in addition, there's another $400 million is necessary as working capital for the general fund. I have before you a one-page handout. It's entitled, When Would the CBRF Reach $1 Billion? And what this table shows is when we would reach this $1 billion minimum level, depending on the price of oil and also the spending level. Your attention is directed to the third column from the right, which is where the price of oil is that which we have included in the fall 2004 revenue forecast, which we are shortly going to review with you. And you see the month and the year that this is projected to run out, depending on the spending level for the period. So that, for instance, if we were looking at a $2.4 billion budget each year going forward, we would be looking at hitting the $1 billion minimum in December of 2008. Certainly, it is difficult to maintain a flat spending over the long run. Alaskans have expectations for the continued level of current services. We have pension problems that Tom just referred to. One of our problems in this structural problem we have is compounded because of the volatility of the price of oil. And the problem of accurately predicting the price of oil as well as predicting production, in short, predicting revenues, is sort of a dicey business. And we will discuss this with you later. The solution, the governor strongly supported the POMV during the last session. I know that you've all very familiar with that. I'd like to remind you that the administration would like to remind you that in our view, the POMV is still on the table for your consideration. We invite you to consider getting active in it again. You may wish to modify what the proposal that the administration has before you, or we are interested in any other proposal you may have to somehow take advantage of the PERMA fund to help pay for the cost of government. And Mr. Chairman, before we move on to the revenue forecast, okay. If there are any questions on our view of the long-term outlook or the state's financial condition, we'd be glad to answer some questions. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to step out for a second. I'll let Mr. Butan.
Sure. Anyone else wants to?
He knows it better than I do.
The only question I had, and then you can ask questions, is you discussed or you reviewed generally that the state's financial condition appeared to be good in the short term, bad in the midterm, and good in the long term, with some major assumptions related to the gas and Anwar development. The bad in the midterm, I didn't get as much information on that. Is that, we're just to believe that it's going to be bad in the midterm because we don't have recurring sources of revenues to meet recurring sources of obligations, and these does it also assume that we're not going to address the long-term liability on PERS and TERS, and we're not going to address these other issues, or what is that bad?
Well, I guess the short answer, Mr. Chairman, to your that question is just yes. Pension liabilities are being addressed with of course, ongoing payments, contributions, and then increases in the contribution rates, and then for the longer term, changes in the defined benefit programs for new hires. So the unfunded pension liabilities are being addressed. There's something the administration inherited, as you know, and contribution rates were reduced during the late 1990s, and so this unfunded pension liability is being addressed, and at least recent pension fund investment earnings results have been more favorable than they were during the 24-month to 30-month bear market. So that is being addressed, but certainly there is a severe implication, a severe timing gap between the near-term prospects, at least as shown by the revenue forecast, and then the timing of income from these further out prospects of gas line income and Anwar.
Just in terms of trying to wrap our minds around some sort of an actual time period, what is the, when you make these projections on the short, mid, and long term, what are the years involved in those?
Well, when we're talking, and I guess if I'm focusing too much on what we say to the credit rating agencies or what they say, because we've just been structuring some debt, maybe that's too much in my mind, but when we're talking to the credit rating agencies, we focus especially on the current year and the coming fiscal year and the liquidity for those fund balance time periods. I think when we go through the revenue forecast, the differentiation between near-term and mid-term and long-term revenues and as the commissioner showed the matrix of when the CBR would go to $1 billion and while the governor is committed to not letting it fall below $1 billion, a matrix is in the forecast that would show also when it would go to zero. I think that all becomes, and of course it's all forecasts, but it all becomes pretty solid in anybody's mind when we go through the revenue forecast.
So short, just so I have it, short term is roughly 2 years, midterm is 08, and long term is 08 beyond.
Sure.
Okay, so I just want Representative Samuels to know that when he analyzes the gas contract.
Comment, Chairman, perhaps add a comment.
Is this Mr. Dickinson?
Yes, this is Dan Dickinson on the line. If you look in the sources book, we do a piece on Anwar, and we basically make the observation that most folks believe that if the legislation passed in Congress this year, it would be 9 to 10 years before we started getting royalties or severance taxes on a regular basis. Obviously, there'd be probably a lease sale in between there. Also, when we talk with the folks under strain of gas contract negotiation, I think the earliest people are looking at, again, is in the 2012-2014 range. So I think we're talking before those two sources sources come on at a minimum of a decade. So as we think about the forecast, at least, that may be the way we define that middle period.
Thanks, Richard Seaton.
Thank you. On your chart here about the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, you indicate that 2004 forecast, oil forecast for DOR was basically $29 a barrel. Is that the level the governor is using in his proposed budget?
I don't have the, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask Dan Dickinson, he's got the...
Sure, thank you, Representative Seaton. Yes, the OMB budget is based on our forecast. I'm not sure which document you're looking at, but typically I think you'll see the first footnote on the one-page summary of appropriations. Usually will lay out the average price for the year and the average or the forecast volume.
Representative Seaton, Representative Bloomberg.
Yes, thank you. And a couple things on PERS and TERS. You indicated a $4.59 billion. Was that unfunded liability or total liability?
That was the unfunded liability of 630.03 as determined by the actuaries, the consultant hired by the Division of Retirement and Benefits and Department of Administration, based on all the algorithms, all the assumptions that an actuary has to use.
Sure. And follow up on that, you mentioned that the administration was looking at change to defined contribution plan for new hires. Is that, I haven't seen a bill on that. Is that an executive order or is that just thoughts or what's happening?
Well, this is, of course, a Department of Administration area, but there are new tiers already in place for new hires. So that's already in place for the defined benefit plans, of course.
Okay, but I think you said that new hires were going to be under defined contribution plan.
Well, of course, state employees have both a defined contribution plan and defined benefit, and for the defined benefit plans, there are new tiers already in place for newer hires.
You'll have to get them in front of state affairs too on that.
Right. Yeah. Appreciate it, Greenberg.
I have several questions. First, I'm going to go. You say you have new tiers. Doesn't that require legislation?
That's why I mentioned state affairs.
Yes, and we'll be dealing with that in state affairs.
That's great, but
well,
let me ask you.
There are a new tier. An employee hired today is not a tier one employee. So that's what I don't know if I'm using the wrong terminology or what, but there are new tiers in place today for new hires that don't apply to the to a hire of many years ago.
Okay. We'll pass on that. Second question. I'm going to go back and forth here for a minute, and I can ask you this, Mr. Bhutan, or the commissioner, or Mr. Dickinson. I'm looking at this very well done fall revenue sources book. I see all kinds of future discussion, and I haven't read it really. Is there anything about is it the future, and or is there anything in here about future for the gas pipeline?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Gruenberg, no, there is nothing about the gas pipeline in this forecast. The forecast done a year ago, the fall revenue forecast for 2003, did consider that. And that was talked about the assumed production. It talked about the fiscal impact that it might have on the state for a gas pipeline, 4.5 billion cubic feet per day, and at $4 gas. And it suggested that, and using the existing tax regime, that would total revenues to the state, including royalties, severance taxes, income taxes, and property taxes to the municipalities, would be in the order of $1 billion a year.
Was there a reason it wasn't mentioned in here?
we every year we try to focus on a new area.
Oh, I see.
And this year we focused more, I mean, ANWR was the...
If possible, I'd like to get a copy of that. I'm not sure that I...
Yes.
I have a few questions for me. With respect to your sheet, when would the CBRF reach a billion? I assume that that the DOR forecast would be $29 a barrel.
Well,
is that what the figure?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the forecast, of course, has different assumptions for different years. For instance, fiscal year 05, we are assuming projecting 43.61. For fiscal year 06, we were projecting 34.50, and 07, I believe, it was 30.95, and then after that, for 2008 through 2015, I think we were assuming 25.50.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Bill, if I can cut in, Representative Gruenberg, those numbers are all found on page 10 of the forecast book.
They're on page 10. Okay, that's great. With respect to your statement about $689 million of state reimbursable school construction debt, would you be able to break that out in writing as to the details of where that goes? And
yes, I actually have that information on my computer, and I'd be glad to...
And we'll be in touch with you on that. Is it in your opinion, under the... And this is... I don't need an answer right now, but I'd like you to think about it and maybe get back to me later on this. The constitutional provision for the CBR says that the legislature may borrow money against it. Is there an opinion, a legal opinion, or do you have anything as to, number one, whether there's an obligation to pay interest on that, and number two, whether there's a constitutional obligation on the legislature to repay that money?
Mr. Chair, I'll look and see if there is an AG opinion on that and get back to you.
Okay. Thank you. Those are my questions.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, mentioned this, but you mentioned the fact that with the PERS and TORS that there were several levels, or several tiers. We right now have tier 1, 2, and 3, and we probably need to deal with a 4, possibly. But you mentioned the fact that there was a divine, that some of them were defined benefit plans and some of them were defined contribution plans. And if I understand it correctly, only the university has the defined contribution plan. Is that correct? Or are there more?
State employees have the so-called supplemental benefit system.
Okay, and that's just an option they have, though, right?
I can't tell you the year anymore, but state employees opted out of Social Security, and so the supplemental benefit system replaces that. And then, of course, additionally, there's a deferred compensation program that's available under some section of the Internal Revenue Code that state employees can and do take advantage of.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is the one that everybody takes part in, whether they want to or not, is for all state employees, is a defined benefit plan, except for the university, which is a defined contribution plan.
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with the university in that respect, but the PERS system is, of course, a defined benefit program.
After these folks, so we'll have former Senator Kelly come up and he can talk about the university.
Mr. Chairman, we're not, don't purport to be...
I understand that. I remember when we talked with the retirement benefits a couple of years ago in state affairs, and I mentioned Tier 4 before discussion, and she didn't know what that was, and I mentioned that was where the employee pays the state to work. So, further follow-up?
Nope, thank you.
Representative Samuels had a question.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, Commissioner. On the forecast prices, does the department keep a record on how accurate and... We get very little input into what OPEC
does. Through the chair, Representative Sands, yes, we do. And what I'd like to do is to go through the forecast, and we do have information on that. And we'll, after we get through with our review, we'd be glad to share that information with the committee.
We're going to have an opportunity to hear from Drs. Williams and Freed, too. Is that right?
Well, we're... Dr. Williams, this is his second day on the job, so he's going to be up here, but
we can just say
hi. Nothing but second guesses.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Dickinson. Oh, Representative Roadberg, I'm sorry.
Representative Roadberg, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two quick questions. Mr. Bouton, the $1 billion minimum in the CBR, does that include the $400 million in working capital as part of the $1 billion, or is that in addition to the $1 billion of 1.4?
Well, Commissioner Corbis can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's sure my recollection that $1 billion is an absolute number and would include any working capital threshold.
So that's inclusive, the $1 billion minimum of goal is inclusive of the working capital number, is that correct?
I have to admit, I haven't been in a lot of discussions that talked about a working capital. There is a $300 to $400 million amount that I've talked to different over the years, legislative committees about that. And I've said in this way, even in a year in which the net draw on the CBR was zero, the state still needs $300 to $400 million throughout the year because of the mismatch of revenues and expenditures on a cash flow basis. That is, very early in the fiscal year, the state is building roads, it has wildfires, and then the reimbursement, to the extent that there is reimbursement from federal funds for highways and even for the federal share of fire suppression, that doesn't come in until later in the fiscal year. So maybe
I understand that. I just was trying to get at the goal in terms of a minimum. Is it 1.4 because of the cash flow needs, or is it $1 billion including the cash flow needs?
Mr. Chairman, if I could take a crack at that through the chair, Representative Roachberg, the $1 billion does include the $400 million. The methodology for developing the $1 billion minimum was that we assumed, that we have a price of oil that comes in at $10 less than what the budget is based on. At $65 million for every $1 change in the price of oil for 1 year, that comes out to about $650 million to cover the volatility in the oil price, plus another $350 to $400 million for a working capital. And so the total of that's about $1 billion.
Thank you. And second question, very briefly, Mr. Chairman, I believe Representative Seaton and Representative Wilson were trying to get at the point of whether or not the administration intends to introduce legislation for a Tier 4, or are you going to be looking at the legislature to take leadership in this? What is the position of the administration?
Through the chair, Representative Roachberg, I would. The Department of Revenue is not involved in that process. I would suggest that we ask the Department of Retirement Benefits to come before you and discuss that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I did though, following up with that
comment, Representative Roe Cook. I did hear an invitation from the legislature to introduce measures related to percent of market value if we're interested. Is that the invitation?
Are you asking me?
Yes, sir.
Yes. We invite the legislature to reconsider the percent of market value or any modification to it or any other ideas that you may have to address our long-term structural financial problem.
Right. Mr. Chairman, on that point?
Yeah, Representative Roper.
I talked to Mr. Burns yesterday and understand right now that the corporation will be sending a request to LBNA for that. Is that what President Samuel, is that what you understand?
I'd have to talk to Senator Cherry about that.
All right. We have Representative Seaton and Representative Grunberg. Okay.
Thank you. I was curious, the governor in his speech said he did an executive order changing the ELF determination for Prudhoe Bay Field to being the entire field, and wondering what the revenue enhancement is going to be from that and if that's incorporated in your figures.
Is that I think it was an administrative order.
It was administrative.
Through the chair, we're not prepared to give you a figure on that at this time. Dan Dickinson, would you expand on that?
Certainly. Thank you. Through the chair, excuse me, we've been asked to wait several days because those are taxpayer-specific numbers to make sure that we've got clearance from the Department of Law as to precisely what we can talk about and what we can't. Just to clarify what happened, a letter went out, a determination letter. We've issued many of them over the years. This one obviously got a little more publicity than most of them. So we haven't necessarily nailed down on these determination letters what is taxpayer-specific and therefore cannot be talked about publicly and what is, in fact, general knowledge. So we're trying to get that nailed down. When we do, and I think we talked about doing that early next week, we will attach revenue numbers to the effect of that decision.
Okay. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you. On that point, even if something can't be talked about publicly, I assume you could talk about it in an executive session to the proper committee. Isn't that correct?
Representative Rubrick, through the chair, I believe that's correct. There are ways that the normal way that we go through any taxpayer confidential information. That's correct. That's in the statute.
Okay. Second question, which was my main question. The administration was pushing last time for a constitutional POMV approach. Would the administration support a statutory approach, POMV, that would not involve the ability to invade the principle of the permanent fund?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, I believe they would.
Thank you.
Commissioner, any further questions of these folks? Anything else on your agenda?
Well, we'd like to present the fall revenue forecast.
Very good.
For you.
Thank you, sir.
Michael, would you come join us? You all should have in front of you a copy of the fall revenue forecast, the gray book here. And I guess I'd like to start out by making a little sales pitch that this is actually a very handy document to have around. You can get it's a lot easier to read than some of the state financial reports, bond offering circulars, and so on and so forth. I just would like to just run through the table of contents with you, just so that you're aware of what's in here. We have the executive summary, which is really gives you what you need to know when you're thinking about the budget. Then we have in the fall forecast, we always have a feature chapter. In this year, it happened to be ANWR. And then we talk about in chapter four the oil revenues quite a bit of detail in breaking that out. And then we have chapter five, which is other revenues. Remember, oil revenues make up 80 to 85% of the state's revenues, but other revenues, corporate income taxes, and all of the various other taxes and other fees and so on and so forth. And then chapter six is a short chapter on the federal revenues. And then finally, we have, not finally, but we have chapter seven, which goes into the discussion of the investment income that from various sources that the state receives. Then we a review of the various endowment funds that the state has, permanent fund, power cost assistance, so on and so forth. Then a chapter on the public corporations. Chapter 10, which is Dan Dickinson's Pride and Joy, which is explains the difference between the various types of accounting systems. And finally, a series of appendices including quite a bit of statistical data of interest. So anyhow, we think it's a great document, and it's we're proud to issue that twice a year. Anyhow, the fall revenue forecast. And just to put things in perspective, yesterday the price of Alaska North Slope oil delivered to the West Coast close was $41.92. And we are now thinking in terms of natural gas, so we start thinking, we're always looking at what the price of gas is doing. And yesterday at the close, for the New York Mercantile Exchange, the price of gas for Henry Hub was $6.13 per million BTU.
Henry Hub?
Henry Hub, which is a ring of pipelines in the Texas, Oklahoma area, and that is probably the most often quoted price for natural gas. If you were to turn to table 2.4 of the forecast on page 10, you would see sort of summarizes the prices that we're projecting for this year and next year and on out into the future. And for this year, that's fiscal year 05, we're projecting $43.61. As I just mentioned, the price of yesterday closed at $41.92. This is interesting. Last spring, and what the budget for fiscal year 05 is based on is $28.30. For fiscal year 06, that's next year, we're projecting $34.50 per barrel. And last spring, we were projecting $25.85. For 2007, we're projecting $30.95. and this compares with $22 last year. For the period from 2008 through 2015, we're projecting $25.50, which is up $3.50 from what we were projecting last spring. So you can see that the outlook for the price of oil is considerably higher than it was last spring. Of course, OPEC, which is a major player in the world as far as oil, they have a stated price goal of keeping it between $22 and 28 cents per barrel. Our estimate, we have assumed $25.50, which is in the mid-range. This is looking longer run. The mid-range of the OPEC. This forecast was prepared, prices were set last October. A lot has happened since then. I would say that our posture today that we are less certain than we used to be that OPEC will maintain the keep within this $22 to $28 price range. We found in recent times, recently in the last several months, that the price differential between West Texas Intermediate, which is probably the most common price quoted in the United States, and Alaska North Slope oil delivered to the West Coast, has widened, and there used to be a much more consistent relationship between these two prices, and this makes our job of predicting the price of Alaska North Slope oil delivered to the West Coast more dicey, more difficult, less reliable in our projections. Price volatility has been with us, and just to give you an example, in 2004 we had a drop of $18 a barrel over a 49-day period. Which is rather substantial, but this type of changes in the price of oil is not uncommon if you look back over history. In the build-up for the second Iraqi oil in 2003, we had a $15 drop over a 48-day period. And back in 1991, in connection with the first Iraqi oil, we had a drop of $15 over a 37-day period. And today, the price of oil is about $42, and that's $8 higher than it was a month ago. So things are jumping around, and I guess as has been said, that we're going through a wild ride. One of the factors, the overall factors that have impacted the recent price of oil, first of all, the demand from China is I think they're the second biggest consumer of oil in the world now, and growth in demand has been spectacular over the last several years. Uncertainty on the supply side, interruptions in Iraq, Russia threatened strikes in Nigeria. The value of the dollar has gone down. That certainly has impacted the price of oil. Most recently, improved U.S. inventories is one of the reasons cited for the drop in the price of oil. and the fear factor, we'll call it, which is a combination of all of the above plus the threat of terrorism, have all impacted the volatility in the price of oil. Alaska oil production. Our forecasts are based upon currently known reserves. For 2005, fiscal year 2005, we are estimating that on average we're going to be producing, or North Slope will be producing 934,000 barrels a day. Looking to the future, we are looking for Point Thompson coming online a little bit later than we had projected in the spring, but we're looking for accelerated production from the NPRA and West Sac. By 2013, we're looking at an average production per day of about 919,000 barrels. It's of interest to note that by 2011, new oil developments will be account for 48.1% of total production. And you're referred to table 2.6 on page 13, 2-6 on page 13. Total unrestricted revenues, and I refer you to page, to table 2-2 on page 5, are estimated to be, based on the price information, price and production information I just gave you, estimated to be $2.98 billion for fiscal year 05. This compares with $2.36 billion for fiscal year 04 and is almost $1 billion greater than the forecast that we made in April. Our forecast in April, we projected $1.96 billion. Looking to 2006, we're projecting revenues of $2.3 billion, and they're going to be lower than the 2.98 we're projecting for fiscal year 05, almost totally because of lower prices. Fiscal year 05, we have projected a surplus of $653 million. This is assuming that the submitted budget of $2.33 billion is approved in the 43.61 average price of oil. The CBR draw, and I refer you to page 2-9 on page 18. We are suggesting that assuming a $2.3 billion budget, that the CBR will run out in total in February of 2011. Now, earlier this morning, we presented a table showing when the CBR will reach the $1 billion level, so I want to make sure that you're not confused by the two tables. One is when the CBR will be totally depleted, and the other one is where it would fall to $1 billion. Retention is directed to figure 2.6 on page 14.
Yes, Mr. Corbis, where we have the DOR forecast, is that the forecast applying the methodology and the varying prices of oil through those years?
Yes.
Okay, so that's not just a single 2004 year. That's 2004 being at 34 and then 30 and then 25.5 throughout the remainder years. Those are the applied to get to these dates.
Well, excuse me, through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'll go back to the prices that I gave you for each of the years. That's on page 10, table 2-4. And the revenues for those various years are based upon the prices included in table 2-4.
Okay, so running out in June 10, or in June of 2010 is based on those prices being applied throughout each
yes,
one of those
right.
individual years. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Back to figure 2-6 on page 14. This is a table illustrating the projected fall off on the ELF going out. And this table, this report was prepared before the governor's announcement on the administrative change, but it does illustrate that the ELF over time is going to fall off, and therefore severance tax revenues are going to fall with time. Again, your attention is directed to chapter 3, page 19 in particular, illustrating the positive illustrating the positive impact that ANWR would have on oil production for the state in the long run. And by the long run, we're talking about the middle of the next decade. In conclusion, thinking about history here, we are at historic high prices. And the outlook for the price of oil is very high compared to times gone by. But we must not forget that the state still has a long-term structural financial problem. And again, you referred to table 2-8 on page 16. Oil price volatility is going to continue, keep this in perspective, this forecast assumes that the price of oil will be $43.61 for fiscal year 05. This was done late last October. So far, for fiscal year 05, the average price of oil has been about $41.84. So we're $1.77 below what we projected. Just the same, last spring we were projecting $28.30, which is $13.54 below the fall forecast. At this juncture, it looks like we may be a little bit overly optimistic for fiscal year 05 for oil revenues. We have taken the oil revenues for the actual price of oil for the fiscal year to date, and then have estimated the price for the remainder of the year using the futures curve, which would suggest that that we're rather than the $653 million deficit, that we will be about $187 million less than that. On the other hand, if we were to take a look at the futures curve for fiscal year 06, the outlook for the price of oil appears to be considerably higher than the $34.50 that we've included in our projections. The next update for the revenue forecast will be in April of this year. And with that, that completes our remarks, and myself and the rest of the team are ready to answer your questions.
Committee, have any questions? Hope
I just wanted to clarify, in your last statement, the 637, you didn't mean deficit, you meant surplus, is that correct?
Yes, I'm sorry. 653, I believe it is, it was a surplus. I'm sorry, okay. I said deficit.
Yeah. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, could we attempt to talk about our ability or our track record as far as predicting the price of oil? I believe that was a question that came up. And Dan Dickinson, would you tackle that one?
Certainly.
Dan, we've got some handouts here. We've got... What ones do you want us to hand out?
I think there are four, and I guess we can probably just go through all four, probably the best thing to do.
Yeah, okay. We're getting those. Go ahead.
Thank you, Bill. And,
thank you.
Chairman Weirich, thank you very much. Let me just touch on one thing. These four that we're going to hand out deal with price. Just want to make a quick observation that, as Bill noted, we're also... It appears we are slightly optimistic on our volume forecast. Again, we talked about volatility. The first week of January, we had record high temperatures on the North Slope. And when you have high temperatures, the compressors aren't efficient. You can't produce as much oil. And so we were about 30 degrees above normal. We had temperatures in the mid-20s, which is January's unusual North Slope. And so far, we've fallen behind by about an average of 13,000 barrels a day this year, which over time would be about 5 million barrels, or about 1% of our forecast. So it's a small difference, but it's interesting. First, we had these record high temperatures, and so we had low production. And a huge windstorm moved in, and there were some safety concerns, so there were some cutbacks on the facilities. And so, again, we had low production. So either the weather sort of too warm, too balmy, or else it's too stormy. In either case, the production got hit. If I can move to the four handouts, these come from different sources, which is why they have sort of different captions. But if I can...
Mr. Dickinson,
yes, sir.
Because my kids are going to ask me, when it's warmer in the North Slope, we pump less oil. Is that right?
That's correct.
And just briefly, why would that be?
And I'm not an engineer, so here's the CPA's explanation. The major constraint on producing oil is handling the gas. At Prudhoe Bay, for example, every day we have to put about 8.5 billion cubic feet out of the ground with the oil, and then have to go to the central compressor plant. You pump back up the pressure, put that back down in the ground. Simply the efficiency of the compressors is related to the temperature of the air. When we do our forecasts, we normally project higher production in the winter, lower production in the summer. And we had, I don't know if it passes for summer conditions, but the higher temperatures mean lower efficiency on compressors.
All right, thanks.
Certainly. The first chart I'd like to look at is one that says absolute percentage error in forecasting oil prices for next year's budget cycle. That's one that folks have in front of them. that?
Yes.
Great. What we've done here is we've simply looked at four respected, well, I'll say respected, we're including ourselves in there, but four folks who go out and do projections. The first one is the Department of Revenue. The next one is the Federal Department of Energy. Another one is the futures as posted on the NYMEX or the New York Mercantile Exchange. And the last one is something put out by CERA, Cambridge Energy Research Association, I think they're a well-known consultant. I think they've consulted with the legislature from time to time. So we basically looked at those. We like to say, gee, we're the most accurate. The absolute error, the amount we've been off every year for the four-year period we're looking at, the most recent four-year period, 17.7%. Of course, maybe Brett said we'll look statistically and say, well, that's not significantly different from 18.9 or 20 or 21.2. I guess the best takeaway message I would say here is that if you look at the class of folks who do forecasts, we have the same kind of accuracy that they do, and for this period, in fact, is just a little bit better. But forecasting can always make you look a little bit silly, and I guess I'd like to suggest that we are doing as well as some of these very high-powered organizations.
Well, Dan, if I could interrupt, or another way of saying it is that we're less wrong than our competitors.
Thank you, yes.
And Dan, you should be aware that Brett has had to leave the room.
Okay, thank you. The next one I'd like to look at, and this is something that the commissioner touched on briefly, is the title is Fiscal Year 2005 ANS Price Actual versus Fall Forecast. And that basically just shows exactly what the commissioner was talking about. We made our forecast in October. We knew the first 4 months, so our actual and the forecast line up. Actually may not be as simple as it sounds when you're trying to reconcile the state's accounting system, but I won't go there very far. You then see the actual and the forecast starting to differ. We basically predicted when we were up in the $50 range that we'd stay there for the quarter. As folks are aware, we did, we dropped away and fell down. So you find in December, for the month of December, there's quite a distinction between where we thought we would be and where we are. On the other hand, we were forecasting that once that quarter was done, the prices would slip and we'd find ourselves in the high 30s, close to 40, and that's where the futures curve also projects we're going to be. So we basically, looking at this chart, we basically have one quarter that we're compared to have missed the prices. If the NYMEX is correct, we'll rejoin an accurate forecast line. And I think, as the commissioner suggested, the area under this curve, by the time you work it through with volumes and all the other pieces, represents a change of just under $200 million. To put these kind of things in a longer framework, I'd like to look at the other two slides. What those two slides do is basically the same thing. One for a three-year piece, one for an 18-month piece. And what they basically do, the brown line or the orange line is the actual price for the year that's indicated. So, for example, looking at the three-year forecast, 2003, the actual price ended up being something around $27. The green line shows where we were 3 years earlier. What did we say the price would be? So in that case, 2003, we said it was going to be 22. And I think as you look, you can see, we tended not to hit it exactly, but we tended to get it about right. We as things went up or things went down, we caught it. We were sometimes off by a year or two. If you go out to an 18-month, you make it a shorter horizon. We're closer to the event, and that's on the other graph. I think, again, you get that sense that we were able to pick up the major trends as things moved around. We missed by several dollars often. But in general, as Bill put it, we're not as wrong as people might think we tend to be. We're never going to hit it right on. The question really is how far off we're going.
Do you build the
the percent error, historical percent of error, into your future modeling calculation? Because you have a track record of error, which is normal and expected, can't you build that past error into your future projections so you accommodate them?
Through the chairman, I'm not sure which representative asked that question, but through the chairman, we, as you'll notice, we use the absolute percentage of error. So the problem is we're not necessarily, sometimes it's high, sometimes it's low. If we were consistent one way or the other, yes, we could. What we would use this for typically is not so much to correct as to suggest a range, to say we think it's going to be between these two points. As we look at the statute under which we issue these reports, we are asked not to give a range or an estimate or give you that kind of information. Ultimately, we're responsible for telling the governor, here's how much money there will be available. You know, here's a number. So you're absolutely right. We should use this information. We could use it to set up a range of variability or how accurate you might expect our forecast to be.
I think in operations research we call that Monte Carlo modeling or something. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mr. Dickinson.
Well, through the chairman, we used to do a Monte Carlo modeling. We used to have a very sophisticated set of approaches. About 8 years ago, this was before my time, so I'm trying to remember the exact dates. We had an economics consulting firm come in, look at our process. They suggested we not use that, but instead went to this, what we call a Delphi process. And one of the things that I've asked Dr. Williams, who has joined our department this week, is again to look at what we're doing, see if there's different ways of doing it that might make more sense, and I'm very interested to hear what he has to say about our process.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The absolute percentage error, are some of those indexes, NYMEX or DOR, are they consistently on one side, underestimating, or consistently overestimating? I mean, these things could be, 35% apart if some of those indexes are consistently on one side of the or the other of the price, or do they all jump around about like DOR?
The chair, Representative Seaton, Dan, would you take that one?
Thank you. Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. In general, they jump around, and let me make an observation on what we find consistently through forecasts, and that is when prices are high, forecasters tend to overestimate the future, and when prices are low, forecasters tend to underestimate. This has been observed in other this phenomenon has been observed in other markets as well, but it's clearly true in oil markets. And I think if you look at if you go back and piece that out, I think you'll find that's true of all three of these. Zach. Basing on his last name, I apologize, but a gentleman in the Treasury has in fact done, Tom Butanshop has done a lot of analysis comparing futures markets and how people look at those and what, how you can try to piece together good information from those predictions. And, I think if there were a bias, if folks were to discover that there was a bias, that information would immediately be used in ways that the bias would disappear. So, no, I don't think any of these sources have a predictable bias built in.
Thank you.
Mr. Mr. Dickinson?
Any other questions?
Kenny? No, this has been useful. I was wondering about these. I don't see it as too much in your talk, but I appreciate the review on this.
I guess I do have a question on the other tax sections you have in here. On the corporate tax, it indicates that that corporations that do part of their business in the state pay. Is that true for all corporations, or do we have major exceptions to that, such as the cruise ship industry exempt from corporate tax, or are there other exceptions as well?
Thank you. Again, I'm not sure which representative asked that question, but through the chair, yes, there is a subset of corporations that are subject to tax under the Alaska Code, and there are many that are not. Probably the three biggest exemptions, or the three biggest differences between the sort of list of total corporations doing business in the state and those that are taxable, are going to be those that are organized under subchapter S of the federal tax code, foreign transportation entities, and finally not-for-profit. I only mention the not-for-profits. I think everyone realizes they are not taxable. Folks may not realize the extent to which not-for-profits constitute a huge sector of the Alaskan economy, a huge sector of the employment piece. To address each of the two specifically, under the federal tax code, corporations can be organized under either subchapter C or subchapter S. The theory is subchapter S is to prevent the so-called double taxation. Subchapter C organization is taxed, corporation is taxed on its profits, then presumably those profits are dividended back to shareholders, and the shareholders get taxed the second time when they get that income. So to prevent that double taxation, certain kinds of smaller corporations are allowed to organize under subchapter S. And what happens is they are not taxed at the entity level when the corporation makes the profit. They're only taxed when the profits are passed back to the owners. Now, of course, if you think about the state of Alaska, we don't tax, we don't put our corporate income tax on the corporation. And then, of course, when the profits are passed back to the owners, we don't have an individual income tax. So a corporation organized under subchapter S will escape taxation in the state of Alaska altogether. The second exception is the application of federal rules that allow foreign air carriers, for example, Korean Air or Lufthansa that might fly through the state, or cruise ship companies that are organized in Norway or Liberia, Bermuda, Panama, do not pay or not subject to the state corporate income tax.
And we'll get into that some more. What I wanted to do is go around the committee. I'm really glad the same people who are here basically are here with us again, and do an opening and closing statement here at the end about what you want to, what you see as your role in Ways and Means and where we need to go. When we started out this committee, a number of people, reporters, have approached me and asked, gee, you know, there's a surplus predicted, why Ways and Means? And I said, well, don't tear up your notes. We're still in the same predicament, I think, generally, in terms of the long term. So, Representative Bloomberg, do you have anything to...
Thank you. I appreciate this. I have to have a floor session here in a minute.
But I want to give everybody...
I think it is most important that we have an ongoing Ways and Means Committee. One of my goals is to see us have a standing Ways and Means Committee. I know we may have considered education committees and things like that too, but over 30 states have standing Ways and Means Committees separate from the appropriations or finance committees. I think that's most important. We need to have some good, solid, long-range fiscal planning in this state, and your comments that that is expected by the bonding agencies, I want to explore with you. I'm looking at the commissioner now. Looking at cruise ship industry, some of these other things. I hope that this committee is far more proactive than it was last year. I'll be very frank. I would like to see us have regular meetings and deal with some of these things. Whether the legislation ultimately passes the first time around is less important than that we get it out there and that we start doing what we need to do to put this state on a long-term, solid, predictable fiscal future.
And with that, we'll try and move your bills.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton?
Oh, thank you. Oh, I appreciate being on the committee. I appreciate your commitment to hear bills. I think it's very important for us to go into each of these proposals and develop the details of and the specifics for each detail, a source of revenue for the state, because until we look at the details, we can't decide whether those are really what the people want us to implement or not. And so I look forward to detailed discussions of these things so that then we have something to fully consider and either accept or reject. to move on. Thank you.
Chairman Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the committee would be a good forum to look at, we can't avoid the issues because oil prices happen to be high right now, but looking at how any particular revenue measure might impact the overall economy of the state, and at least not have a fear of talking about any of them where I personally agree with some of them or don't agree with some of them. We certainly can't be afraid to discuss them. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson?
Well, I agree with what everyone said. I think just because we have a surplus, in fact, now that we do have a surplus, this is the perfect time for us to be dealing with this because we all know that whatever we put into place, we just can't say, yes, we're going to do it, and it's in place next year. It takes a while for all the regulations to be worked on and everything else, and so if we had a big drop all at once in the economy and the price of oil just bottomed out, we would be in bad trouble. And so we need to prepare ahead of time for that so that our it's not such a devastating effect all overall on our economy.
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do believe the commissioner's admonition about a structural long-term deficit problem is accurate. One thing, Mr. Chairman, I'd like the committee to continue working on. Under the leadership of the 23rd legislature, Chairman Hocker was working on what I call the Ways and Means Expenditure Forecast. Previously, the Department of Revenue used fundamentally a flatline expenditure projection, and I believe that the legislature should undertake, and this committee particularly, follow up the work that Representative Hocker started last year by creating a forecasting model for near-term and mid-term expenditures that show such things as impacts of health and social services, our pensions, and other issues that are going to impact the budget, and so we can have a better working model in that regard. And I look forward to working with the committee on all of these issues.
Thank you, Representative Roper. Commissioner Corbis, there's some new folks with the department here. I just wanted to introduce for the benefit of the public, you have a new special assistant, Jerry Burnett.
Jerry Burnett, yes. Okay. That's the only one that's
okay.
New.
And then we look forward to working with your new economist.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dickinson, are you still there? Dan? Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to pick that up next time. I think that what the House of Representatives, it started the Ways and Means Committee because in the House of Representatives believes that there's a problem that needs addressing and fixing. And the House of Representatives has actively considered revenue measures and controversial subjects and, in fact, has passed them as a body in a bipartisan manner. Reformation of this revenue, of this Ways and Means Committee, I think is a very strong signal to the public that the House is very committed to continuing the work of the last Ways and Means Committee chaired by Representative Hocker and then before that co-chaired by Representative Jim Whitaker and Representative Mike Hocker. And I think the committee did do a good job of breaking ground on a new committee to look at the ways we finance government and the means that we want to use to finance state government. When Representative Seaton and I came into office, and when Representative Wilson has been in office, Representative Samuels came into office, and Representative Roper has seen this for a long time, we came in with about a $650 million deficit. And now, thanks to the serendipity of the world economy, we don't have that deficit, and people are talking about a surplus. How much surplus is subject to some debate. But I think Representative Wilson has put her finger on it. We can't fit and start move this state forward in a predictable fashion that attracts private investment capital to this state with a state budget that just predicts on the wind and what may happen in the oil markets. And we want to have an investment climate where our children can work, and we want to have a stable source of revenues to pay for those recurring sources of debt. And this committee is charged with looking at ways to raise those monies and raise and deal with mechanisms to have a long-term, stable state government that is financed in an appropriate manner. The appropriate manner is always a political debate.
But I'm proud to be part of this committee. I'm proud to be part of this House that's willing to tackle those tough issues and move controversial subjects forward, and we plan to do that. And the better information we can get from the department on how to do this, and the better close and working relationship we have with you, I think it is in all of our interests and the public interest too. So we're going to do all these meetings out in the open. We're going to have as much discussion as possible. And until we get bills for consideration, we're going to start looking at these so that we have this kind of government we all want to live in. So I'm really glad to work with Representative Wilson again, and Representative Seaton, Representative Samuels, Representative Wolfberg, and Representative Moses is on the committee, and Representative Bloomberg. So let's charge on and earn our money.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an honor for the Department of Revenue to be your first guest, and we look forward to working with you in the future during this session.
Well, as we said before, we've always appreciated that you, Commissioner, have always personally attended these and not simply relied on somebody else, although very competent. You've always been a leadership model for other commissioners, and we appreciate your personal attendance.
Thank you.
All right, committee will stand adjourned, subject to call of chair. Yeah.